This podcast was recorded at the 2015 JAD Pro Live at APSHA Conference. The title of this session is Updates in the Treatment of Metastatic Colorectal Cancer, and it is presented by John Marshall, MD, Georgetown University, and Robin Summers, DNP, ANPBC, AOCNP, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. To view the presentation slides or to claim continuing educational credit for this activity, please visit www.advancedpractitioner.com/JADPRO Live 2015. Now we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JAD Pro Live.
Things were on. Thank you very much for that kind invitation. Thank you guys for sticking it out and hanging in there. It's not sunny at all outside. It's terrible. And so you might as well be here. So talking about something cheerful like colon cancer. So thanks very much for sticking it out. Robin and I are going to spend the next hour or so kind of going through. I'm going to start by going through some data. Robin's got some cases that are going to walk us through. We're going to do our post questions again. I think we have plenty of time for Q&A to really talk about colorectal cancer and all that's happening in that disease. So with that, let's dive in. These are my disclosures. These are the learning objectives, and I believe they're printed elsewhere for you in other places. But let's set the stage, really, for this disease, because when you ask anybody in the clinic, a fellow resident nurse, anybody, what the most common cancer is, what does everybody always answer? Lung cancer, right? And, you know, the Chinese are doing everything in their power to make them number one in that, too. They're smoking their way to that. And then we talk about breast cancer and prostate cancer, but the reality is, those of us who do GI oncology for a living know that we, in fact, sadly, are the most common, most fatal collection of cancers on the planet. And when you look at what's going to happen over the next couple of decades, you recognize that this is a major public health problem. Right now, today, around the world, only about 1 in 7 people on our planet has access to any form of cancer care. And so as the emerging middle class around the world who happen to have cell phones and Wi-Fi but not access to cancer care, they know they don't have access to cancer care. One of our biggest struggles out there is how are we going to deliver that to those people? Because cancer care in the United States and really in most of Western society today is a luxury item. It is like shopping at Nordstrom's with somebody else's credit card, all right? Which is a lot of fun to do if you've ever done that. But how are we going to get it to a place where the whole world can afford complex cancer care? It's not just the drugs. Everything we do is expensive. If you thought about what you need to do to deliver cancer care, you need a CAT scanner, you need interventional radiology, you need surgeons, you need an infusion unit, you need a hospital, right? You need all sorts of equipment to deliver even basic cancer care. And we haven't really figured out how we're going to deal with this really important problem. But beyond this, forget about common, which of the cancers is by far the most common? The most important. Which one? There's a correct answer to this. It's not colorectal. It's absolutely not. Come on, what color did every NFL team color, huh? It's by far the most important cancer on our planet. 10 times more funding for breast cancer than all the other cancers combined, right? And that's within our federal budget, by the way. So that's policy. I come from Washington. That's our policy, is that breast cancer is by far, it's the one we're racing to cure. I hate October. And the first Sunday in October, the football game comes on, or you get on an airplane in the pink tie or the pink towels or whatever, and the initial reaction is warmth, right? That's a good thing. There's somebody paying attention to cancer. But what do you think the people who don't have breast cancer think when they turn on that first Sunday in October? What? You know, it's like we're racing to cure this one, but screw the rest. They're left behind. And they really feel that way, but they cannot say that out loud. It is sacred. Breast cancer is sacred, and they can't say that to anybody. Because who knows, their friend might have had it, right? And so we have to change this. We have to balance this out. Because which one kills more people, colon cancer or breast cancer? We somehow need to balance this out in our society. And so part of our job today is to get this in the loop, be aware of this. So everybody in the room learned that colon cancer happens like this, that we start with this benign polypy thing, and over time mutations occur, and then you get invasive cancer, then it spreads to the lymph nodes, and finally ultimately spreads to other areas, metastasizes the liver, lungs, and places like that. And we believe this, we justified and based all of our drug development on this theory that metastatic disease is where we test our drugs, and then we bring it to stage 2 and stage 3 disease, where it turned out the drugs that worked in metastatic disease don't work in the adjuvant setting. Only two do, 5-FU and oxaliplatin, are the only two drugs that work in stage 2 and stage 3 disease. So there's a disconnect. We maybe learned wrong about the whole biology of colorectal cancer. And so we are now beginning to sort the disease into its various molecular subtypes. Everybody knows HER2, ERPR, right? Triple negative for breast cancer. In colon cancer, we have microsatellite unstable or not, microsatellite stable or not, and KRAS mutations or not, and we'll discuss both of these in turn. But it turns out that what we thought all colon cancer was the same, maybe not. Young is different than old. Right-sided is different than left-sided colon cancer. And maybe, just maybe, we've been looking at the wrong side of the equation, because everybody just took a break and fed their little colony that lives inside them. I like to think of it as a coral reef. It's much more pleasing to think about it as a coral reef. It's in lovely balance. Everybody's got a different coral reef out there. You, somebody who put chocolate in their coral reef just now? Who's put that evil carcinogen bacon in their coral reef? Said, yeah, it's great, wasn't it? Yeah. So it turns out that your coral reef matters. So everybody knows alcohol causes colon cancer, right? Not for everybody. You have to have the right kind of bacteria. If you have the right kind of bacteria and you drink alcohol, you turn the alcohol into an aldehyde, which is a carcinogen. But if you don't have that bacteria, the bar is open now, I think, you know. So it's all right. So it turns out that we are interacting with our environment incredibly intimately with our coral reef, and how we understand that and how it influences different kinds of colon cancer is just beginning to be understood. So now we look at a very complex map like this, and it's evolving to where side matters, the different gene profiles matter, and we're beginning finally to sort colon cancer into the different molecular diseases that it is, and with this we will see even further improvement in outcomes. Now I want to really focus mostly on metastatic colon cancer today, because that's where most of the action has been happening. And the first thing any of us is to do when we see a brand new patient with metastatic colon cancer, I don't care if we're the first doctor that's seen him or nurse, or we're the 30th, we want to stop and think, is this patient potentially resectable? Now that was blasphemy 20,000 years ago when I learned the world of oncology. You didn't operate on metastatic disease. There were going to be more weeds in the garden. There was never just one or two weeds in the garden. But it turned out in colorectal cancer, that's not so. There sometimes are just a few metastases. And we don't really have a marker for that, but when we find it, if you know this, we're going after these metastases. Pictures have gotten better, surgeons have gotten better, the recovery from this is very quick. And so we're now going whittling on all sorts of patients. So you can see on one side, is the patient potentially resectable? Because some of those patients will be cured of their metastatic colon cancer. Not by chemo, but by surgeons or radiofrequency ablation, this kind of thing. But unfortunately, most folks are stuck on the other side of this graph, where they have too many weeds in the garden, or the weeds are in such bad places that surgery is not really going to be possible. And these are the people where we have to play an elegant chess game that's all of a sudden become longer and longer and longer as we have new medicines going forward. Now, I'm not going to pretend to cover all of the chess game. We're really going to focus mostly on frontline therapy today, because that's where some of the hot stuff is. But we can talk about that during the Q&A if you like. So here's all the chess pieces. For 40 years, we had one drug. What was the one drug? You bought the T-shirt. 5-FU. And with 5FU, the median survival of patients with metastatic colon cancer was somewhere around 10 months. Don't get attached. Go back and take care of your breast cancer patients. Right? Now, with all of these new medicines, we're actually seeing patients live 3+ years on the backs of this chess game, trying the different medicines. And you see we have 5FU, irinotecan, capecitabine, there's oral 5FU, oxaliplatin. The biologics come in. We have 2 EGFR inhibitors, cetuximab and panitumumab. We have 3 VEGF inhibitors, Bev, aflibercept and ramucirumab, all of which are pretty much the same. You have now TAS-102 that got approved 2 weeks ago, and about a year or so ago we got regorafenib, Stivarga approved. And with these chess pieces and playing them wisely, patients are living longer and longer with their metastatic disease. Here are the curves. When I started as an oncologist, I promise I'm not claiming the success, but it's been fun to watch. So that was the average survival. And now, in the most recent clinical trial, in the format quite right, we now have a near 30-month improvement in 30 months of median survival. This graph depicts how it's not just the first treatment that we give. That's the blue line there. That's been about the same, whether it's FOLFOX or FOLFIRI or biologics or other things. It's been about the same over many, many kinds of trials. It is the orange line, which has gone up, and these are subsequent lines of therapy. Second, third, fourth moves on the chessboard with patients. So this concept of making sure you expose all the patients to all the drugs was born on the backs of these kinds of analyses. And you can see the survival really comes from these subsequent lines of therapy. I'm just going to do a few clinical trials which make some main points, and then we're going to get in and do some cases, which is a lot more fun. So this is the TRIBE clinical trial. I like to think of this as the kitchen sink versus the bathroom sink. Right? So FOLFOX Eerie Bev. Anybody prescribed that one yet? Given that out? So that's the kitchen. Everybody knows what FOLFOX looks like. Does everybody know that? So Metaports, 2-day infusion pump. Has anybody in this room actually ever worn an infusion pump for 2 days? Huh? How many have you hooked up? Right? It's mean what we do to people. It is. They go home and the pump upsets the cat and the batteries go crazy. It gets caught when they get up to pee and gets stuck under the bed and pull, you know, right? We should try that. We should actually all take one home, don't tell, tie it around your neck and carry it for 40, take a shower with one, right? See how that goes. And you have to put batteries in it. It has to whir, okay? So that's part of the deal. But this is oxaliplatin, irinotecan, and PUB5FU and bevacizumab versus FOLFIRI Bev. And it turns out that this clinical trial is positive. It actually worked well. But one of the things that emerged was this BRAF mutated patient. It's only about 9-10% of all colon cancer. And we think of it as a bad cancer, as a mean, fast-growing cancer. But the kitchen sink, if you give that to the patient, you actually show an improvement in outcome. And so instead of just picking whichever treatment I feel like giving today, we're beginning to say, okay, if you have this molecular subtype or this kind of tumor, we're going to give you this recipe and be smarter about this. Right? Does that make sense? And this is coming on the backs of this. We mentioned in the pre-case this concept of maintenance therapy, and this is very common in a lot of cancers now. And it was first really worked out by some French scientists, physicians, who randomized patients between what I like to call a European vacation and a U.S. vacation. So they got their front line, say, FOLFOX plus bevacizumab, and you can't keep giving FOLFOX, right, because you get neuropathy. You get this cumulative neuropathy from it. So half the patients on this study kept getting oxaliplatin until they couldn't tie their shoes. The other got just 5-FU. And it turned out that less was just as good. It worked fine. But they went one step further and did a study where half the patients got the 5-FU and the other half got nothing. No treatment whatsoever. What I call it, what do Europeans do when they go on vacation? They shut the shop, right? They go to the beach, they turn off their phone, they take off their clothes, and they sit down, right? That's what they do. What do we do when we go to the beach? Right? You have this, I'll be right there. I'll be right, you go play this hole, I got this call, all right? Let me do my emails, then we'll go, right? Is this whose vacation is that? And if you don't, you really get in trouble, right? If you take a week off and don't do your emails, you're smeared, right? So you have to, right? So it turns out doing a U.S. vacation was a little better than doing a European vacation. But this is a European study, and it's called the Cairo 3 study, and half the patients after their initial combination chemotherapy got just capecitabine, Xeloda, and bevacizumab, Avastin. Not the traditional 2 week on, 1 week off dosing, but low continuous dosing of capecitabine, which is very well tolerated, by the way, versus observation, so a European vacation. And it turns out that it doubles their progression-free survival, so 8 months compared to 4 if we keep a little something going. And this is a nice break. They come in every 3 weeks for a hit of Bev, their oral chemotherapy, and you tell them, on average, 8 months before your cancer is going to grow again. That's a nice break in the chess game for patients with metastatic colon cancer, so quickly becoming a standard. Now, I want to shift gears and make sure everybody in the room understands this concept of RAS testing and what we're talking about and why. So using breast cancer science was the concept of trickle-down research, that if you funded breast cancer science, it would help all the other cancers, right? So using that, when we developed HER1 drugs, you all know about HER2 drugs, EGFR is HER1, a cousin. So we said, if it's going to work, you need a receptor, right? Because you need HER2 receptors. Well, you got to have a receptor. And the original clinical trials were driven around receptor-positive colon cancer. And it turned out that didn't seem to make any difference. But we were still seeing some patients benefit and some patients not. And it turned out that it was something downstream, that little pink, Benjamin Moore 1412, I think, that RAS thing right there, where it was broken in about 40% of patients. We now know it's about 60% of patients, but at the time about 40. And broken, stuck in the on position. The engine's revving. So if you think of the receptor as a gas pedal, this is something under the hood that's busted, right? And so we were measuring gas pedals when we were really not measuring that little fancy sensor that Volkswagen inserted to keep the cars running, you know? That's what it was. And so if you have a broken, mutated RAS gene, if your tumor does, then these drugs don't work. You can do anything you want to the gas pedal. It's going to rev. The engine's still going to rev under the hood. Okay? But we didn't understand that. Now, let's go one deeper. Because we draw these kinds of diagrams, you've seen hundreds of them, as this very structured sort of, I like to think of it as a pool game. You hit the ball just the right way, all the other balls go in their right direction. But is targeting, is molecular signaling really like that? Or is it much more like the diagram on the other side, which is actually a diagram of my daughter Emma's room? Now, a couple of you in the audience actually know Emma. And Emma's incredibly smart. She does perfectly in school. But her room, actually, mostly when she was a teenager, looked like that. And she said that if we moved one of her socks, she would not be able to find her math book. That somehow, those two things were connected. So what we look in here is which one of these is really right, okay? And so we did an experiment. And we took the same pathway that we're all used to seeing, and we ping the EGFR receptor. We turn it on. And we don't just measure the stuff that we know about, right? We measure every single protein and gene in that cell. And when you do this, not only do the stars sort of realign, but I bet it'll be this way tonight if you go outside, the stars really come out. And when you ping the EGFR receptor, 638 genes move. What do parents do with a kid like Emma in that room? You shut the door. What do molecular biologists do when it turns out it's Emma's room? You shut the door, and we draw it back the other way. We can't measure this. We don't know how to understand it, right? There's a wonderful finding that at least 60% of this haystack comes out with just one gene, RAS. But there's more to come, right? That's personalized medicine, and that's what we need to figure out how to go forward. So just in a rough depiction, if you just give receptors, only about 1 in 10 patients responds. If you start to enrich around the patients with the right molecular profile, you see the response rate go up and up. And so on that backdrop, the belief was is that we had a good target that we could really drive against. And if that's true, then using the EGFR therapies in frontline therapy should win. right? If you find the right patient, give them the right drug, they should win. And this is the first of the two clinical trials I'm going to show you. It's called FIRE-3, European study, and has caused a rift between what used to be a very collegial relationship between U.S. GI oncologists and the European group. So FIRE-3 is a smaller 600-patient study. Half got FOLFIRI cetuximab, and the other half got FOLFIRI bevacizumab, frontline chemotherapy. And the curves, it was actually powered for response rate, which is sort of unusual. And you can see that, yeah, maybe the cetuximab side of things was a little higher response rate, but not statistically so. But really, what shook everything is these are the progression-free survival curves. Now, these are the chosen people, right? The EGFR arm should be coming out of this, but it's not. They're sitting right on top of each other. But then when you look at overall survival, this really funny thing happens. If you could draw a line up from 12 months, okay, that's about how long the patients were on their initial chemotherapy, the clinical trial, and the curves are right on top of each other. It's not until maybe 6 months, a year later, that the curves actually separate. And the Europeans take this to say that EGFR therapy frontline in the RAS wild-type patients is the right thing to do. And we're like, wait a minute, because we've got a U.S. study that tells us something different. This is the all-RAS data on that same clinical trial. But in the United States, made in the good old U.S. of A., right? This is an 1,100-patient study chaired by a guy named Alan Vanook, who's great. And this was the same idea. You could pick your poison, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, but then in the RAS wild-type patient, you're randomized to either get cetuximab or bevacizumab in front line, right? Same basic trial. And in this clinical trial, we learned about new exons. I'm not going to drill down on that too much. But here you see that there really isn't any difference in the curves in that tail. And we believe in the United States is that if you play all the chess pieces properly, the curves stay together. The Europeans tend to be a little less heavy-handed with subsequent lines of therapy. Some of that is a value decision they are making, a money decision, because the medicines are expensive and keeping them going. But if you use all of the chess pieces, you actually see no difference one for the other. So in the United States, there still is a bias to use VEGF drugs like bevacizumab in frontline, even in the RAS wild-type patient, whereas in Europe there tends to be more use of the EGFR drugs. You know why the EGFR drugs are a little hard to give? Rash. You get an acne-like rash, a pimply. Somebody pull up on your phone, put in cetuximab grade 3 rash images. Dare ya. It's not pretty. It's not a pretty rash. And so while the drugs do work very nicely, it has a very public side effect that we have to worry about and deal with. And I won't go through this, belabor this too much, but the one outlier arm on this, on the very bottom there, is the 25-month of the FOLFIRI Bev. And we believe in the U.S. that's because they didn't use much in the way of biologics in through the second and third line. Second real controversial area is that we've created this new kind of patient. They're stage 4, no evidence of disease. We've taken out their liver met, we've taken out their lung met, and now what do? We tend to like to give pre-op chemo, no data to support that. We often will give adjuvant, a magic 6 months of chemotherapy. Does anybody know where that number 6 months comes from? We just pulled it out of our tail, folks. So we feel compelled to give 12 cycles, right? Like that's some magic number. That's not really true. Are we treating metastatic disease or are we treating adjuvantly? Adjuvant therapy is a little like, you know, killing seeds that can live in your garage over the winter, little crunchy things. Whereas treating metastatic disease is small plants, right? And our drugs don't cure small plants. They help, but they don't cure. Our drugs cure the little crunchy seeds that are out there. And so if you've already got small plants growing, probably the other things are small plants too. So we don't really have evidence that there is an adjuvant effect in this patient population. So the rationale around giving it chemotherapy is we want to see the biology. We think we're giving micrometastatic disease, the small seeds, some treatment. We can maybe help with surgery. But the downside is that we make people sick. There's toxicity from all of this. And so we have to weigh it against those two things. We only have one study. we conclude different things from this study, is why I'm bringing it to you, is that, again, done in Europe, that's where all really good research is done, half the patients got surgery alone, the other half got FOLFOX for 3 months, then surgery, then some more FOLFOX, just like you see here. And it turned out that there was a difference in about 3 years of 8%, but then as you kept going out, there really wasn't. The curves came together. If you had an adjuvant effect, the curves would have stayed apart. You would have cured some people of their metastatic cancer, whereas others you wouldn't, right? And we never see that. So I take this as it doesn't really have the adjuvant effect. Others say, yes, it does, but the study wasn't powered to find that small difference. So we can still quibble about it, but it's quite controversial out there. And here's a study that says, well, just throw stuff at them. This is very much what we do in cancer medicine. You got a new drug, try it. Well, this was a study using cetuximab, one of the EGFR drugs, in the same metastatic window. And even when you enriched for RAS, this is kind of scary because if you look there, the experimental arm is below. It was worse. It was tumor food, right? And so this idea that drugs that work in the metastatic setting will also work in the adjuvant setting, again, not borne out, in fact, harmful in this subset, in this clinical trial done, again, this was done in Great Britain. All right? The biggest news in colorectal cancer was presented at ASCO by Dung Lee. She's fabulous. This group did a great clinical trial. You all know what mismatch repair is? Colon cancer comes in two basic flavors. Okay? If you think about the big pie, 80% of the pie is that classic polyp cancer, right? You make a polyp, the polyp evolves into more stuff, right? But 20% of the pie has completely different biology. And the different biology is mismatch repair. Some of the 20%, actually 5 of the 20, inherited it. And that's called the Lynch syndrome, or HNPCC. Okay? But some people just picked it up along the way. They didn't actually, not can't blame your parents, they just got it because they ate too much bacon. That's what. So, you know, something, right? They just picked it up along the way. And so if it turns out, if you have MSI high, and you can do this test on all our patients, we used to only do it in young people, and we would do it in patients where we suspected the syndrome, but that's about it. But now, with this data, if you use PD-1 blockers, you all know about these, immune therapy, this is hot stuff. But in the roughly 4 to 5% of metastatic colon cancer patients who have MSI-high tumors, almost all of them respond. So the red bars here are the patients who had benign polyp colon cancer, right? And the green bars are those patients who had MSI-high either colon cancer or in black there, I think is the color, other mismatch repair tumors. And when you give PD-1 inhibitors to this subgroup of patients, it works in everybody. So we all of a sudden, on the backs of this small study, New England Journal, big presentation at ASCO, right? Not a big randomized study, small, right drug, right patient, right time, transform. This drug will be approved very quickly for these patients, and you can get it now if you had one. So we're looking at everybody. This thing on the, looks like a spider, it's called a spider plot. And you can see these are durable responses. The swimmer's plot are the ones that are in the lanes there. These responses last for a long period of time. And so this is dramatic impact in the right patients. So all patients with colon cancer are now testing for microsatellite instability in the hopes of this. I'm going to close my comments a little bit to kind of talk about the future of oncology and developing drugs and how are we going to go forward. Because everybody in this room is an employee of an incredible industry of oncology, right? We work privately, we work in the healthcare industry, we do all sorts of bits of it, but it's a big business. It used to be a kind of small business where everybody knew everybody, and now it's huge, multi-bazillion dollar business, right? So how are we going to go forward? Everybody knows we're in a little bit of hot water, right? We're expensive. Can we justify what we do? And so when one looks at risk-benefit ratio, what's on the scale right now is what we normally measure. Overall survival. Does it have a palliative effect? I think of hope is really what patient reports. You know, their quality of life, I would say, is hope. On the other side, we have, of course, toxicity and despair, but we don't put cost on here, and we don't actually put harm. It turns out that some of our drugs push the curve down, not push it up. It's not a no harm, no foul setting. So when we empirically give people treatment and hope it works 8 weeks later, some of those patients we're hurting, we're shortening their time. And we don't really know how to measure that or incorporate it into our decision making. So price is what you pay, value is what you get, but this is how we're going to be judged going forward as a new metric in the world of cancer. But how are we going to measure this? So like in Washington, we're going to follow this recipe, right? This is exactly what they do over on Capitol Hill. They come together, they listen to each other, they respect what they hear, right? This is it, right? We're going to give them all guns and see how it goes. We're going to find the common thread, right? And we do weave a new fabric. But this is a very important way we have to go forward in our complex big world that we live in. I believe precision medicine will be one of the ways that we come together. That by doing prospective profiling on patients, we will learn more. Everyone in this room, if you had metastatic whatever, you'd want your tumor profiled. Because there are rare targets where we have great drugs. We learn a lot in the process of doing broad molecular profiling. But right now, it's not clear that this is going to be covered through health insurance. But one of the things we have to do is begin to do drug development on the backs of this. And we need to do it on a big scale. So no cooperative group, no healthcare service can actually do this. We have to have a big fat pipe of patients flowing through. Just as an example, what if I wanted to do a 50-patient study of a new drug for colon cancer, common illness, but the target is only expressed in 10% of patients, and arguably that's a common expression. And if I want to do that study in a year, I have to screen 43 patients a month to find my 50 patients. Okay? And no center can do that, and no company wants to profile 100 people to find 10 and throw the 90 away. And no patient wants to wait around to see if they're one of the 10. Right? Give me some. Let's go. Right? And so what we need is a portfolio. And you know about these bucket studies. You've heard of them, basket trials, where molecular testing is done and there is a portfolio of different options depending on what genes are mutated in what patients. And this is the way forward. The phase 3 randomized study is dying in exchange for this. And it's how I would want to be treated. I would want you to biopsy my tumor and do state-of-the-art profiling and have at my ready the right drugs that you think are the smartest thing for me to have based on my gene profiling. That's how I'd want to be treated. But we have to do this in a shared, cooperative manner. We have to share our data. Our cancer patients, HIPAA is a terrible law. Cancer patients are more than ready to give you whatever you want. Take some, please, and study it, right? This whole concept that they are unwilling to have that shared is just not true. And we need to figure out how to do that, right? And our EMRs, we are all highly paid data entry specialists. Do you feel that way some days? Yeah, maybe not so highly paid, some highly paid. That's what we do. And we don't do it all very well. Some of us are really good documenters, use all the pull downs, and some of us just type it all in, which is useless, right? So we need to be better at data collection for our patients as well. So yesterday and tomorrow, we're in the middle somewhere here. We were in a world of consumption. The more I ordered, the more tests I did, the more money we made. We're now on a world of outcomes. We're going from individual practices to systems, rich countries to all, as you can see here. So lots of big change over time. And we're going to go to our case studies. So I'm afraid I'm taking way too much of our time. So Robin's turn. There you go.
So I'm going to share with you a case. It's actually a case that I took care of this patient probably a couple of years ago. Things have changed. You know, it's not very specific. I changed around some of the details. But I think it really ties in very nicely. You'll see some controversial points. I think all of us may have a different way on how we're going to manage this case after listening to Dr. Marshall's very enlightening presentation. So this is a 49-year-old perimenopausal Caucasian female, had a 2-month history of abdominal cramping and intermittent vomiting, had a colonoscopy which showed an obstructing lesion, and biopsies were taken. The pathology revealed a moderately differentiated invasive adenocarcinoma. Her CEA was elevated. Her CAT scan showed multiple small lesions in both lobes of the liver, the largest one measuring about 1 centimeter. There was irregular concentric thickening consistent with her primary, and there was no lymphadenopathy. So just listening to that patient, we all know multidisciplinary care really is the standard of care nowadays. It's after listening especially to Dr. Marshall's talk, determining the best treatment option in treating colon cancer patients is very, very difficult. And so a multidisciplinary team of all these different professionals, and I neglected to even put in a genetic counsel in here because they should be at least an outlier because our patients are sometimes referred to them, come together to try to determine what the best treatment plan is. They develop the plan, keeping in mind the patient's medical, physical, and other supportive care needs that may affect their care. So with that being said, now treatment is no longer just the responsibility of the sole oncologist or the surgeon. It's now a team of multiple professionals. I'm lucky I work in a cancer center, and so we have all these different disciplines. All our patients are referred to a multidisciplinary clinic. Not all these people will be together at the same time, but certainly if it's a rectal patient, we may have a radiation oncologist. We certainly will have our social workers are available in case there's issues. We'll have a surgeon. We have a radiologist, the oncologist, et cetera. So collaborative practice, we've heard a lot about that, and I'm hoping that all of you had the chance to read the publication that's hot off the press that was put in all our bags upon arrival on collaborative practice and the role of the advanced practice nurse in oncology. So with that being said, there's been a lot said about our roles moving forward. ASCO's predicted a significant shortage of oncologists over the next decade. The number of people visiting oncologists is expected to increase by about 48%, and the supply is not going to meet that demand. So ASCO actually published in 2011 a study that really looked at the use of advanced practice clinicians in oncology care. And they actually found, the results of that study actually found that they really referred to them as non-physician providers. I'll refer to them as advanced practice clinicians. But in that study, they actually found that NPs or PAs can help improve productivity within a clinical practice, that MD and advanced practice clinicians were satisfied with the collaborative practice model, and more importantly, that patients understood what collaborative care was. They understood who they were being taken care of. So these are just some of the roles that an advanced practice clinician will provide in this type of model. And if I queried everybody in this room, there's probably a number of us that practice in different ways. There's the independent model where the nurse practitioner is in rural practice and she's seeing all these patients by themselves. We're restricted by our state governance, which tells us how we can practice. Most of us are in a collaborative model, but even in that, and even within the institute that I work with, we have varying different models. So we had the primarily independent model, but could be blended if you have a CAT scan, patient has progression of disease, your physician's in clinic with you, and he has to come in the room. You have the model that the MP goes into the room, she comes back out of the room, she gives report to the physician, and then the physician and the nurse practitioner or the PA go back in the room and see the patient together. And so a lot of it is looking at how we can best meet the needs of the practice, improve access to care, which is a big crunch right now. Cancer incidence is increasing, and so we're trying to figure out how we can get new patients in. So adding an advanced practice clinician or into the practice may help because they can see the follow-up patients that allows the physician to therefore see the new patients. And with that said, Dr. Shulman in 2013 actually also conducted a similar study, and the four or five major things that he found was adding advanced practice clinicians, yes, it can improve productivity. Yes, it improved patient care because it was actually patient satisfaction surveys that were sent out. Yes, there was satisfaction between the MD and the advanced practice clinician. Yes, the advanced practice clinician can help see urgent patients. And yes, we can also help provide coverage for our physicians, especially those physicians that are in academic practices, that travel, have academic responsibilities, have teaching responsibilities, have research responsibilities, that we can actually help make a difference in a good model. So with that being said, the patient that we just talked about, and I pointed it out, I don't have the laser pointer. Oh, that's okay. Well, anyway, it's pointed out on the screen, but you can see that this is the patient's primary cancer that's here, an obstructed lesion. A little bit more about her history, had a history of GERD, past surgical history was DNC. There was no family history of cancer in the family. She's married, she has three children, and she's a non-smoker and she does not drink alcohol. So what would you recommend for this patient at that time based on the information that's been given to you so far? Initiate chemotherapy for metastatic disease, biopsy the liver lesion, order a PET CT, recommend a surgery consult, or both B and D. And we can see the result here. We have a great audience, both B and D, 74%. And looking at these options, again, and listening to Dr. Marshall's presentation, you would have queried probably another provider, and it may have been a different answer there. So to carry on with the case study, the patient underwent a partial colectomy with laparoscopic liver biopsy and insertion of a power port. Three spots were found in the liver. One of them was accessible. The pathology revealed an adenocarcinoma, mucinous type, invasion to the serosa, adhesion to the transverse colon wall. Liver biopsy was positive for metastatic disease, consistent with the primary, and the path was read as KRAS mutant. So the patient was a stage 4, N1C, no lymph nodes, and M1A tumor. And here you can see the liver lesion on this film. And again, this is a CAT scan, and sometimes on CT imaging studies, it's very difficult, depending on the phase of contrast, to see these. So at times, sometimes an MRI is ordered. So when treating or making treatment recommendations, certainly the oncologist, in collaboration with his colleague, we all look at what are some of the comorbid conditions. And so you want to know, when we just saw all those drugs that are now available for colon cancer patients, certainly, you know, if you're considering FOLFOX with the oxaliplatin neuropathy, do you want to give it to a patient that's a diabetic and already has baseline neuropathy? You're considering adding bevacizumab to frontline regimen and you have a patient that is poorly controlled hypertensive. So all those things really need to be taken into consideration. Performance status. How well is the patient functioning and are they going to be able to tolerate aggressive therapy? Financial concerns, as we just heard, the cost of these therapeutic treatment regimens are really very, very high, and a lot of our patients have co-pays that they have to meet in order to have the treatment. Social support, getting back and forth to the clinics. Their occupation and what do they do for work? Are they going to be able to continue working? And certainly the patient preference. How many of us had a patient that said, I don't want a port put in. I don't want to be hooked up to that pump that Dr. Marshall explained. So what do you think the next reasonable treatment option for this patient would be? A, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI plus canotuzumab or cetuximab, KPOX plus Bev, undergoing a liver resection, or either A and C? And about a third of the audience chose one, and the last answer, A or C, 50%. So we have a little bit of variation between the first answer and the last answer. So looking at the NCCN guidelines, and I apologize because I actually went online this morning, and version 2016 is now posted. So this just following the NCCN guidelines for the rationale behind that last answer, patient had a colectomy, and this is that kind of area, is it neoadjuvant, is it adjuvant therapy? The patient had a colectomy followed by chemotherapy, and if this is a patient that you're really deeming maybe potentially resectable, then you'd want to restage this patient certainly in a couple of, after a couple of months of therapy to see if it's, they would be a candidate. So in our practice in particular, you know, the physician determines the treatment recommendations, and usually that's discussed in clinic. Patients don't usually start clinic the same day that the doctor has gone over the results of all their tests and then they've decided on a treatment option. So the patients generally will come back to clinic and then they'll meet with the advanced practice clinician and we'll go over and review the side effects that the physician had gone over and again reinforcing the information that was given, going over the potential management of some of those, discussing birth control if it's applicable, reviewing insurance coverage, because how many times do we write prescriptions for all those other medications that they're going to go on for the management of those side effects to find out that there's coverage issues, and certainly if the patient needs any referrals for nutrition or social support. So the patient comes in for the fourth cycle of FOLFOX. There's tingling. She has tingling in her fingers and her toes. Again, no gross motor or fine motor dysfunction. And again, thinking about this case was a few years ago, goes on calcium and magnesium infusions pre- and post-oxaliplatin. So how many of us way back when calcium and magnesium was in vogue and we're like, yep, going to put everyone on calcium and magnesium because we're going to try to prevent that neurotoxicity from occurring very early? Well, lo and behold, so we gave calcium and magnesium, and then other studies came out, as you can see on the screen, negating what the first study said. And so, okay, now we're not going to give calcium and magnesium. And then another study came out and said, no, really, I think it's okay to give calcium and magnesium. It might offer the patient some benefit. We finally have answers in 2014 in the results of the most recent trial. It was a randomized three-arm trial that actually concluded no benefit to using calcium magnesium to protect against the oxaliplatin neurotoxicity. So in this restage and scans following four cycles show that the liver lesions appear to be consistent with benign lesions. So this was a very, very challenging case. The CEA level has normalized. The MRI shows liver lesions, two of them are cystic. It actually wrote in the report that the change may be consistent with treated liver lesions. So it was unclear whether they were benign or malignant. And the PET scan did not light up. So what would you do next? Continue chemotherapy, evaluate eligibility for a clinical trial, a surgery consult, or repeat biopsy? We have about half the audience saying a surgery consult. And that is the correct answer in this particular case. The other answer was reasonable about thinking about another biopsy. So this patient in particular actually went back to the surgeon for the surgery consult, and he actually presented three different options to her. One was he would go in and she would be deemed inoperable. Two, that these lesions were, in fact, benign, and four, that there may be complications, et cetera. So there really was a three-arm tree, but the patient had opted and with the physician's recommendation to go on to surgery. And the NCCN guidelines here, again, we had talked about really reevaluating this patient for conversion after a couple of months. So the patient went on and had a right hepatectomy. It showed a 2-millimeter focus of metastatic disease in addition to granulomas and resumed postoperative adjuvant therapy for the total of 6 months. So this was one of those cases that we had a little bit of controversy in, you know, who's neoadjuvant, who's adjuvant, and how many cycles and where did we come up with that number. So this just shows you a picture. I'm like, I love to have visual ideas. So this just shows her resection margin. And just in surveillance, because this patient is high risk for recurrence, so according to the NCCN guidelines, and I won't read all this, I'll refer you to the guidelines, certainly that the surveillance monitoring for this patient with stage 4 disease is pretty close. In addition, in the colonoscopy, because she had an obstructed lesion, you wouldn't want to wait a whole year to get another colonoscopy. They're recommending it sooner. So in summary, multidisciplinary team, collaboration is essential, and most of us have tumor boards that are available to us in multidisciplinary treatment clinics, effective team with trust, respect, communication, and certainly establishing a practice that best meets the needs of your division, and more importantly, the best needs of our patients. Thank you.
This concludes this podcast from the 2015 JAD Pro Live at OPSHO Conference. To view these slides and claim your educational credit, or to view other programs from this meeting, please visit education.annenberg.net/JADProLive2015.